You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Thursday, March 23rd, 2017. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of law at Fordham University, Zephyr Teachout, on Neil Gorsuch and the corruption unique to Donald Trump and not. Also on the program today, Chuck Schumer, vertebrate. Meanwhile, Devin Nunes walks over to the White House and tells them something about the investigation.
We got eyes on you.
And then Schiff says, both these guys are the House Intel leaders, that evidence is more than circumstantial.
You shouldn't have told them that, Kevin Nunes. That was very bad.
ISIS claims that the British terror attack was by an ISIS follower. And, of course, repeal and replace on the rocks or not. Lastly, it also turns out Donald Trump did want a North Korean-style military parade for the inauguration. All that and more on today's program.
Sure did.
Another day, ladies and gentlemen, of just an incredible amount of news.
Feeling tired, Sam?
Yeah, I am.
Drained?
Actually.
Cocked.
Almost forgot about this London attack because of the enormous amounts of news that was happening. But, of course, five people killed, I think at least at this point, 40-some-odd injured. A guy who I guess apparently was known by British police, a 52-year-old man, British man, named Khalid Massoud, had been, British police were aware of him. They did not perceive him as a threat, had no evidence that he was going to do something like this. He had previous convictions for violence, unclear. On top of which, that's coming from me. On top of which, police have arrested eight people in raids around Britain. Unclear in what, for what reasons, if they were involved in this or not. But ISIS has claimed that he was a follower of theirs. Unclear as to whether or not he left the country and came back. My sense is that's unlikely because they were not on top of this guy in that way. But we will wait for more information. Meanwhile, in this country, just another insane day yesterday where, and we'll get to Gorsuch, obviously, with Zephyr Teachout in just a moment. But sometime around 2 or 3 p.m., Devin Nunes, who is the Republican leader of the Senate Intelligence Committee, House Intelligence Committee. And the intelligence committees, as you probably know, are considered to be the most bipartisan of all the committees. Because, of course, this involves American national security, and supposedly this is never politicized. You know, we've theorized here that James Comey did not want to tell where the reason why James Comey did not, even in closed session, confirm or deny the existence of an investigation to the House Intelligence Committee up until basically the other day was because Jeff Sessions, that Comey was afraid that Nunes would tell someone in the Trump administration, because this was a guy who was so closely affiliated with Trump that he was part of the transition team. And Comey did not go in front of the House Intelligence Committee until Jeff Sessions was safely recused and could not quash the investigation. And then Devin Nunes yesterday, and it's sort of unclear because he's been really unclear about it, was given information from a member of the intelligence community who was not a leader in the context of the intelligence community, which showed that the Trump administration, and including Donald Trump himself, had been, were incidental. There was perhaps intelligence, a wiretap, or were incidentally picked up on a wiretap. So presumably, if we can make out what Nunes is saying, that these members of the administration were in conversation with people who had been, were being surveilled. Nunes kept sort of changing his story. And frankly, we don't know if that's actually what he told the president in the White House. We just know that he went over there to tell them something without telling any of his other colleagues, told the press. And so if what he's saying is true, he was leaking information from an investigation, which apparently, according to the Republicans the other day, is one of the worst things you can do. It's one of the absolute worst things you can do. And then Adam Schiff went on television and said, yeah, remember how I said the other day we have circumstantial evidence? And he used, we'll play the audio of this later. Well, we got more than that. Supposedly it was not related to what Nunes did. And then there was a CNN story that broke last night that went just Adam Schiff plus in terms of how much evidence there was. So we'll talk more about that in the program. But the good news is that in the wake of the Gorsuch hearings, in fact, I think they're still going on. I think there are Gorsuch hearings right now where they're hearing from witnesses, people who were on the wrong side of some of the key cases that we'll talk about with Zephyr Teachout. And sometime yesterday, Elizabeth Warren, maybe it was 2 days ago now, I can't, it's, everything's blurring together. Elizabeth Warren said, there's no way we should be allowing, following the revelations on Monday, we should be allowing a president under federal investigation to have a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court. And seems like a reasonable argument to make, at least one that I think is going to resonate. And here is Chuck Schumer, not the most liberal member of his caucus, but the leader of his caucus, going out and making a pronouncement that I imagine he would not make unless he had some reason to believe that he could deliver in terms of the votes needed for a filibuster. And here is Chuck Schumer on the floor.
The Supreme Court matters a great, great deal. It matters for workers who want to protect both their lives and their jobs, for employees who need to be able to seek redress for discrimination, for parents who want their kids to get a fair shake in the education system. It is with all this in mind that I have come to a decision about the current nominee. After careful deliberation, I have concluded that I cannot nomination to the Supreme Court. His nomination will have a cloture vote. He will have to earn 60 votes for confirmation. My vote will be no, and I urge my colleagues to do the same.
And so here he is setting it up. He's going to have to earn 60 votes, which suggests that the Democrats are going to attempt to filibuster. Well, I think it's explicit. He's going to, they are going to attempt to filibuster. Whether or not he will be able to hold the caucus, it remains to be seen. He needs to hold six votes, and unclear if he can do that, but...
Do you think Manchin will be one of those votes? Because he was on Meet the Press yesterday talking about Russia.
I mean, the thing about this is the thing that Elizabeth Warren does when coming out with that, and then Chuck Schumer followed quickly, is Russia gives a guy like Manchin cover to vote against cloture. Russia is...
It's the Ruskies, man.
Yep.
Serious business.
And this is pretty low ball stuff. And I guess if you're worried about a nuclear confrontation over the pronouncement that... put aside Russia. It doesn't have to be Russia. The FBI has said that we're investigating the Trump administration. It could be for anything. It just so happens to be these contacts, which I think, you know, if they were colluding, really, actually, even with, let's say, Russian mafiosa.
Even them.
Even if it was like Italian mafiosa.
Even those guys. Who'd have thunk it?
Colluding with them to hack into the DNC servers, that's still a problem and should not end up probably causing World War III.
How ironic would it be if it did somehow end up involving the Italian mafia and it was literally a fat guy in New Jersey
that hacked into it? Exactly.
That would be how I'd love this all to end.
I think something like that is, at least from the perspective of the Trump administration, I have a feeling if any of this is true, I imagine that's what it was. They were... colluding, if it's true, I don't know if it is, but if they were colluding with somebody that they didn't realize they were talking to Russian agents, they were just talking to Russian mafia.
You think you're dealing with the mafia, and then you think they're dealing with the, what do they wear, name tags? You think you're dealing with the mafia, it's a government, totally unfair.
Fake
totally
mafia.
Unfair. Fake mafia. I've been dealing with the mafia for years.
Fake mafia. That's what I've been saying.
And so I call it the fake mafia because they're government.
If it helps for a couple of votes on filibustering Gorsuch, I'm all for it. And then the ball will be in Mitch McConnell's court, and he will have to either they'll have to nominate somebody else, and the beauty of that is, of course, it's not about Gorsuch at that point, right? For those half dozen votes, it's about the FBI investigation. Or he's going to have to nuke the filibuster for the Supreme Court to place on the Supreme Court a nominee of a president under FBI investigation, which, if I had to bet, is exactly what he's going to do. But at least there will be some political value to the Democrats down the road if he does that. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Zephyr Teachout.
Burning down the house. Hold tight.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Professor of Law, Associate Professor of Law at Fordham University, and a former gubernatorial and congressional candidate in the state of New York. And full disclosure, I voted for her in both those races. Zephyr Teachout. Zephyr, welcome to the program.
Wonderful to be back on.
So I want to start, obviously we're talking about Gorsuch, but you know, it's interesting. The Democrats in their opening statements to Gorsuch, really tied him into a larger theme that fits everything that's happening, if one could actually believe that these days. Basically, the corruption of our political process, sort of both writ large and writ small, if what we can say, Donald Trump's corruption is writ small. But you are on sort of both ends of that spectrum. I mean, there's a lot of things that are going on these days that are right in your wheelhouse. And I just want to start about with an op-ed you wrote in the Washington Post about the way that Neil Gorsuch understands economic and political power. Just give us your sense or your analysis of the way he understands that power.
Well, look, he's a Scalia judge, and you know, even Republicans call it the Scalia seat and compare him to Scalia, and he's been open in his praise of Scalia. So both in that and in his opinions, you can see that he has a really what you basically might call a neoliberal view of who should have power and how people should make decisions, which is deeply skeptical of government, pretty top down, very much in favor of billionaires having unlimited power in elections, and then also in favor of allowing mergers and incredible concentration of power in the economic sphere. So it codes itself as neutral. It's not neutral. It codes itself as originalist. It's not originalist. What it really is an approach that is cynical about government and instead says, billionaires want to spend money. They should be allowed to spend unlimited amounts of money. And there's a concurrence, a lot has been made about his concurrences in the last few days, rightly so. He had a concurrence in a money and politics decision a few years back where he actually suggested he might even go farther than Scalia and might, nothing said directly, this is Gorsuch, so it's a lot encoded, but might consider applying strict scrutiny to campaign contributions, which would basically mean the possibility of not just Citizens United, but striking down the capacity of individuals and maybe even corporations to give unlimited sums directly to candidates.
Because
contributions are fundamental political speech. And this is actually a pretty radical view.
Let me just explain to people, when you say strict scrutiny, that means that any law that in any way deals with that stuff has to reach a very, very high bar in terms of its necessity and the sort of the compelling state reason to have a law like that. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And there's sort of a saying in law schools that if it's strict in theory is fatal in fact. I'll translate that, which is that when you hear that strict scrutiny is about to be applied to democratically passed law, that typically means that law will no longer exist after the justices are through with it.
And what's
I just want to emphasize. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I mean, what's interesting about that is while he will write that in an opinion, he really took the tack of during the hearings, it seems to me, and in his justification of what people have come to know as the frozen trucker opinion, that judges shouldn't get involved in there. I mean, the idea of this guy applying strict scrutiny to what the legislation does, to what the legislator does, I mean, to me, that parallels, I guess, like Scalia when it comes to the Voting Rights Act.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I actually find his hearings quite chilling. Speaking of Trans Am, so you mentioned the frozen trucker case. This is the case where Judge Gorsuch dissents, and we can go into the facts.
Yes.
But his defense of that case at the time in the text of his dissent and now, and this is a case in which a trucker repeatedly calls for help in sub-zero temperature, falls asleep with a numb and wakes up with a numb torso. He cannot feel his feet. He waits. His company tells him not to move. And he ultimately, after waiting for hours in sub-zero temperature, unhitches the trailer that he's attached to so that he can drive to warmth.
Right. The trailer, we should say, in terms of facts, the trailer was basically jammed. The brakes were locked on the trailer itself, but not on the cab, on the truck. And so he unhitched it so that he could...
Right, and so he's doing the right thing.
Right. Yeah. So that he could get
to warmth. And he first stops because it's extremely dangerous to have the trailer, the jammed up trailer on the road. So he pulls over, which is the right thing to do for public safety, calls, and there is a federal law that deals with this, which says, so he gets fired. He gets fired for disobeying orders, for actually leaving the trailer. And there's the federal law that deals with this says that, no, you can't actually fire an employee who refused to operate a vehicle when the employee has a reasonable fear of serious injury. And what the majority says in that case is very reasonable reading of this is that he was refusing the operating instructions of his company and he had a reasonable fear of injury. So you can't fire him for it. And what Gorsuch says is that he did not refuse to operate the vehicle. He, in fact, drove the vehicle to warmth. But what's I think really chilling about this is that Gorsuch claims he's using a technical approach, just purely technical, just reading the text of the statute. Because, look, he actually drove the vehicle. That's what he says in his dissent. But actually, driving is not the language of the text. It's operating. And refusing to operate, the sort of common sense understanding of that is refusing to operate it in the way that you've been asked to operate it by your boss. So he claims textualism, but in fact is willing to bring his own very original interpretations to bear. And in that way, he really reminds me, I think he's, you know, a deep Scaliaist, but reminds me of Judge, now Justice Roberts, who said he was going to only call balls and strikes, right. And then actually invented a new doctrine that had not existed before in striking down the Voting Rights Act. So what's chilling about it is that the facade of neutrality is just blatantly false. There's nothing neutral here. There's nothing. He's not just being a technical robot. He's actually being. He's going out of his way to interpret a statute in a way that doesn't make sense.
And the issue there in terms of implicating the Chevron doctrine, which was a doctrine developed in this case involving Chevron, where an agency, when you have a question, in this instance, what does it mean to operate a vehicle that is a commercial vehicle? What does it mean to operate a vehicle? That the agency... it basically determines what that is. And so it's not just that he's getting that picky with and redefining operate as to mean just drive, but it's that he's overruling an executive agency, which is sort of the professional bureaucracy and basically how, you know, the legislature uses this, right? Because you don't want the legislature to sort of get into the nitty gritty of what constitutes operations of a trucker trailer unit. And he overruled that, which basically undercuts the ability of just broadly speaking, regulation in our country.
Yeah. So what just to sort of repeat, and then I want to point out something that I find particularly disturbing in this area, is that there's a longstanding doctrine. This is, as you refer to, the Chevron doctrine, that says basically when applying, we're going to defer to experts within an agency when they themselves interpret their own statutes. Now, I actually think there's a really rich debate around Chevron. What is really striking is that Gorsuch pretends in a bunch of other areas to be an absolute adherent to precedent and uses precedent as something to hide behind, as a shield to say, I was just following precedent. And we can talk about his case involving the autistic student to show yes. how he doesn't do that when he says he is. But he says, I'm just following precedent. I'm not bringing any independent, original thinking to bear. But that's just not true, because everybody understands, and he's very open in a series of dissents and concurrences and opinions, that he is skeptical of this general approach towards deferring towards federal agencies. So even if you, and I actually might be more willing than others on the left to, certainly not to overturn Chevron, but to talk about the scope of Chevron deference. But what I'm not willing to do is to say, Judge Gorsuch, you get to, in some areas, say it's just precedent, and in other areas, bring your own original thinking to bear and be very open about it. So in the trucking decision, he is, and in several other decisions, he's basically defying Supreme Court precedents, not merely following it. So when he says, I don't want to weigh in on Citizens United, I'm not going to tell you, you know, Roe versus Wade is precedents, I'm not going to tell you how I'm going to weigh in on those things, those kinds of responses, I believe, in the crisis moment we're at in our democracy, where the Supreme Court plays such a central governance role, is not acceptable. Our Supreme Court has too much power for us to accept the non-answers from justices. And I think a lot of people, I think it's unfortunate, actually a lot of the press, with lots of good exceptions, have sort of treated this like we're still in the 80s, everything's fine, the world's right. working, not that we're in a crisis, and therefore we should apply the same standards that we did in the 80s of sort of letting these justices go, not almost applauding them for their success in not answering questions, saying Gorsuch had a great day because he didn't answer any questions.
But this is a little bit off topic. But don't you think that? But don't you think that's a problem with the legal profession? I mean, because the greatest amplifiers of that perspective, it seemed to me, are attorneys who are like so impressed with.
I was wondering what you're saying, I've certainly seen it with my colleagues. It's a kind of default saying, well, he's smart, therefore he should be our Supreme Court justice.
And it seems to me,
and I got to tell you,
well, but it seems to me,
Justice Scalia was smart, but he certainly did a good job on taking a knife to our democracy.
Well, I mean, it seems to me that there is a sort of there's a little bit of denial in within the legal profession of mm-hmm. what has happened to the Supreme Court. I mean, that has been my my experience and my observation really since the Gore v. Bush. And and there's been a sort of a willful denial at that point. I mean, if you ever needed an argument that, hey, wait a second, this isn't
an apolitical.
Yes. And it occurs to me, and I do want to talk about this idea thing, but it occurs to me that what Gorsuch is doing in this Trans Am case is mm-hmm. that he is signaling, right? Because a guy this age now, his age in particular, knows if he is on a track, he knows he's got to watch out for certain things, right? Like on the left, now you can't work for the ACLU if you really want to be a Supreme Court justice, right? That day is gone mm-hmm. now. People are worried about that because this will be brought up. For a guy like Gorsuch, when he focuses on that word operate and basically questions, he attempts to roll back the regulatory agency's authority, but absolutely. Hides it and shrouds it in an argument about the definition of a word, which is sort of like a second order attack on that agency's authority. He's both signaling to people on the right, hey, I'm here. If you want Chevron gone, I'm your guy. Which it seems to me is one of like, you know, abortion, Roe and Chevron are sort of the holy grails, it seems, on the right. That's his way of doing it. Am I reading into that too much?
I have no idea whether he was, you know, angling for the court or not. He's certainly been a very ambitious judge. But he succeeded. That was the goal. He succeeded in becoming sort of the dream justice for a very hard right approach in a series of areas. And he certainly, you know, if you're right about that, he was signaling in his concurrence, you know, a somewhat unnecessary concurrence in the Money and Politics case, that if you're worried, and this isn't signaling to the hard right, I think this is what's so disturbing, this is signaling to the oligarchs, you know, this is signaling to the Mercers and the people who are funding the campaign to support him right now. This is supporting to the Koch brothers, signaling to the Koch brothers. I'm not about to overturn Citizens United. If anything, I might go farther in freeing your hand. And I think, of course, one of the unfortunate things that's happening in our society, and why Gorsuch's nomination is so important, is that we're not in an ideological left-right fight. We are in that too, but we're also in a really big money, and we're not, you know, not trivial money. We're in a Mercer Koch effort to take over the very core of our democracy. And I happen to think that not coming out to fundamentally question Citizens United actually means that you shouldn't be a Supreme Court justice, because this is about, you know, whether we can have a democracy at all.
And just to put a finer point on that, I guess it was the Washington Post has wrote the other day that it's been a 20-1 margin with conservative groups outspending liberal groups on pro-Gorsuch ads across the country. Let's talk about the Mercers. I mean, I can talk about the IDEA case a little bit later, but there's a lot being written about Robert and Rebecca Mercer right now in the context of Donald Trump. And what I don't think people realize is that, as far as I can tell, his second biggest investment, if not his first, in this past election, was against you in a seat the 19th district in New York, with running against a guy named
John Faso. Yeah.
So,
I would love to find out if there's anybody who came close, but because it may be true, but as far as I know, he spent, his family spent around $700,000, supporting my opponent, John Faso. So, I don't know whether to take that as a badge of honor or not.
Why do you think that was? Do you think that was because he didn't want you, or do you think he wanted Faso, or what was that?
You know, I imagine it's a blend. He had had a prior relationship with Faso. It's a swing district. I was called a special threat by super PACs on the attack. They were justifying why there were other friendly to Mercer super PACs that came in at the last minute to spend another $1 million as a special threat in this district. And, you know, one of the reasons maybe that I talked so much about super PACs, and in fact, I had actually challenged Robert Mercer to a debate because he'd spent so much money in my election. I really felt like I was running against the Mercers. And Jane Mayer's piece is an absolute must read for anybody, the piece in the New Yorker about the Mercer family. But Mercer and his allies spent more money than my opponent. So my opponent's spending in a general election a little under $2 million, and the super PACs are spending over $6 million. So the race then feels like it's a race against super PACs instead of the opponent. Sometimes the press still treats it like it's, again, like it's 1999 or
right.
It's as if it's a race between two individuals, when in fact the attack ads are all coming from Mercer backed operations.
And the story of the Mercers and Citizens United is very intertwined, because they didn't really get involved in the political process until basically the shackles were taken off. And that's when they started dumping in millions upon millions upon millions of dollars. And you know, hopefully we're going to get Jane Mayer on to talk about that piece. But the long and short of it is Mercer gave $11 million to Breitbart back in 2010, I think it was. Subsequently was the guy and his daughter were the ones who brought Bannon, into the Trump campaign. Rebecca Mercer, I think, still has an office or had one during the transition. And these folks are the embody the heart of what Trumpism is in many respects. And we don't have too much time because I wanted to get into also your
involvement. And they're deep. I mean, they're fundamental, like not philosophical anarchists, but just anti the existence of government.
Yes.
Really wanting to dismantle the whole thing. Around Citizens United, you're talking about the problem with lawyers. I certainly had colleagues in the law school world who disagreed with Citizens United, but sort of said, well, it's not going to be that big a deal. Just think the difference. I thought about it all the time when I was running for Congress, the difference between running that exact same race in 2016 and 2008. It'd be a totally different race. You've had less than a decade, and now the world is transformed by Mercers who were not key players in 2008. I mean, there was a money problem, believe me. We weren't in heaven then. Now, when you think about, does this Gorsuch thing really matter? Do we really need to filibuster? Well, we might lose, so is it worth trying? This is a fundamental moral fight for the future of our country, and we have to do everything we can to try to stop it.
Well, I mean, you know, Sheldon Whitehouse has been talking about money in politics, and he's made the point.
He's been terrific,
and he was great on the Gorsuch hearings. But he's made the point in the past to me that it's not just about the elections; it's about a guy walking into your office and saying, like, you know, you either vote for this, or I'm going to dump $3 million to your opponent. So it's not just the money that it's the sort of the veiled threat that comes with this and knowing that they have the ability to do that. So let me just ask you about that. Can you tie in the emoluments lawsuit that I know you're a part of that involves three or four things that Donald Trump has already been doing in office that violates the emoluments clause of the Constitution? Mm-hmm. But that sort of like lowbrow corruption and this highbrow corruption, right? Because it's on a spectrum, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, they're all related in this way. In both the case of Trump taking money and benefits from, among others, the Chinese government, the government of Turkey, dozens of countries around the world through both his development projects and through his ownership of the Trump Tower, where the government of China's entity owned by the government of China is one of the largest tenants. In that case, we know two different things. One is the president is making really critical decisions about our trade relationships. I'm just going to use China with China, and our military relationship with China. And the president is in a position to be made richer or poorer by the government of China. We don't know that there's any secret deals. We don't know that there's a smoking gun. We just know that that is the situation. likewise, with money being spent and bills being passed, a lot of the times we're not going to find evidence. The Koch brothers are pretty brazen today with saying, hey, we'll support you if you vote no on,
right.
on the bill, and we won't if you don't. But most of the time there's spending and there's bills. And there's not a smoking gun. And the thing that connects them is we got to stop looking for smoking guns. I would say that's true in the Gorsuch hearings. I would say that's true in the way that we think about corruption. Because, you know, maybe I'm pushing this metaphor. Like, we're drowning. The house is on fire. We don't need to find the little facts that slipped from one Chinese government official to our president to say there's something wrong about our president getting enriched by a country that we're in trade negotiations with. And we don't need to find a fax from the Mercers to John Faso to say there's something really wrong with Faso being so dependent on a billionaire who has no interest in the Hudson Valley.
Right.
That is itself wrong. We have to sort of understand that to fight corruption, we're going to have to block the activity itself, not sort of hunt around for the secret, explicit deal.
The very existence of money as a such a major force involved in the whole process is corruptive in and of itself.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's corruptive for two reasons. One is it's really rare that either of two parties for a bribe come forward and confess. It's not really sort of done that you take a bribe and then say, hey, by the way, I took a bribe. So it's one of the, it's a kind of activity that's really hard to uncover, even when it is pretty open. And the other is, come on. I mean, human nature tells you that when your job's dependent upon somebody else liking you or not, you're gonna work for them, essentially. So you shouldn't have to need that explicit favor to have influence. And we've certainly seen that, across the board in our Congress.
In that bribe scenario, we have at least one example of a guy who was actually sort of basically paying that money, who conceded that's why he did it, and he's now the president of the United States, working it probably from the other angle. Zephyr Teachout, thank you so much for your time today. I know you got to run, but I would love to do this again. Really appreciate it.
Wonderful. It's a pleasure to be on. Great to talk to you. Have a great afternoon.
Okay, take you care. Too. Thanks again. All right, folks. Before we go, I do want to cover. We didn't have the time to go over it with Zephyr Teachout, but I do want to talk about this idea ruling. And this was an opinion that came down from the Supreme Court. We only have eight justices right now. It was not a split court at all. It was actually a unanimous decision by the Supreme Court. That came down and basically, I mean, I think this was just a coincidence, drew attention to an opinion issued by Gorsuch on the 10th Circuit. It's a 2008 opinion, which involved the Individuals with Disability Education Act idea. This came up quite a bit with Betsy DeVos, too. And it's an act that requires public school systems, which takes federal funds, which I believe all do, more or less, that they provide a free, appropriate public education to certain classes of students with disabilities. And there was a case in 2008. And I believe it was the, it had the same, it was Thompson RJ School District versus Luke P. was the 2008 case. The Supreme Court had a case, a different case involving a different school district. And in the 2008 case, Gorsuch wrote that the school district complies with the law, with the IDEA Act, so long as they provide education benefits that must merely be more than de minimis. Now, de minimis is Latin for so small that you can, it's completely insignificant. It's basically means nothing. So small that it's basically nothing. And when he was questioned about this, Gorsuch, about this case, because the Supreme Court basically came down and said, no, just slightly more. Well, when he was questioned about writing merely de minimis, that the school complied because it provided something that was better than merely de minimis, Roberts wrote in his decision from the Supreme Court, when all is said and done, a student offered an educational program providing, quote, merely more than de minimis, progress from year to year can hardly be said to have been offered an education at all. So, in other words, Gorsuch, who claims he was following precedent, added the word merely from a precedent that already existed. There was already a precedent that involved, like, you have to offer more than nothing. And nothing became, more than nothing became the floor of what you must offer. After Gorsuch was done with this ruling, it was actually the bar is just something more than nothing. Now, that's a very subtle distinction, but I want to make it really clear that people understand. More than nothing means that at the very least, it has to be more than nothing. Merely more than nothing means that's all you have to do. More than nothing, we don't know exactly where it is. Merely more than nothing, we know, is just above nothing. And that's what he's saying it has to be offered in terms of education for students. So he, A, is a heartless SOB. B, was not following precedent, but was shaping precedent, slightly shaving that precedent. Put a little garnish on it, which fundamentally changed the taste of that that precedent. And it fundamentally changed it so much so that he was shot down by 8 justices on the Supreme Court. So it just gives you a sense of how meticulous this guy was as a judge, but also how ruthless. And good for the Supreme Court shooting that down. And remember this too. One, he was not following precedent here. He was shaping the precedent. But two, when you get on the Supreme Court, you do not have the same obligations to follow precedent that you do when you're on a lower court. You give deference to it, but it's something that you can change. We've seen that with the Supreme Court now.
What would his motivations be for wanting to lower the bar so much?
He has hostility towards public education. He doesn't feel that government should be in a position where they have to offer more than just slightly more than nothing. And that's why. I mean, you know, this is a mentality.
He's a rabid ideologue. Like all these other people.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically what it comes down to.
Money involvement or something like that?
No, I don't think it's... I think it's an ideologue. I just think he believes that government should not have certain obligations and should not have certain powers. And what's worse is he claims otherwise. He claims, I'm just calling balls and strikes.
Yeah, the irony, I keep noting the irony that it's only Democratic-appointed judges that are remotely honest when they talk like that. It's only the Sotomayors and the Kagans who say, like, well, I actually really look at precedent for something like
that's
that.
That's not ironic. That's depressing.
It is depressing.
All of the above. They should do less of that, too, though.
He also, according to Rick Hassan over at, I think, SCOTUS blog, specifically misrepresented what the Citizens United holding was, saying that Congress has room to enact expenditure limits if they want to. And... he said this, I think after Citizens United made clear that quid pro quo corruption remains a vital concern and a subject for potential legislation. Okay, so that's what Zephyr Teachout was talking about, where you have evidence of an actual bribe. I give you this, you give me that. He's saying that's still obviously a vital concern and subject for potential legislation. He says, and I think there's ample room for this body to legislate, even in light of Citizens United, whether it has to do with contribution limits, whether it has to do with expenditure limits, or whether it has to do with disclosure requirements, the court has indicated that proof of corruption can be demonstrated and a different result may obtain on expenditure limits. And so he's saying if there was proof of corruption, not a quid pro quo, but the type of corruption that, like, the Koch brothers said they're going to give money for people who vote a certain way. He's claiming that the court left open room for that type of legislation to attack that. Hassan says this is incorrect. In American Tradition Partnership v. Bullock, the Supreme Court majority, same majority in Citizens United, held that it would not consider evidence of corruption to justify a spending limit. It would not. So, I mean, there you have it. I mean, this is what Gorsuch, but at the end of the day, the bottom line is, are Democrats going to find the political will to maintain a filibuster? And it would be nice if they could do so on the grounds that we heard from everybody on the Senate Judiciary Committee who are making this broader argument. And I think all of those seven or eight Democrats are going to be voting, I would imagine, for a filibuster to not vote for cloture. Feinstein, we'll see. But if it takes, you know, the FBI is investigating the president of the United States, so maybe we shouldn't give him a pick to get another four or five on board, I'm down with that. That's what politics is about. My hopes that Joe Manchin was going to be my favorite Democratic senator were never. They never materialized. I never even had the hopes. I think it was when he was shooting the carbon tax with a semi-automatic weapon for his ads for his election. And I knew this guy wasn't going to be my buddy.
Yeah, I can't see you two at the commissary together.
No, we wouldn't hang out at the commissary. I'd take his pudding.
Pudding? I love pudding. So Jews always snagging my pudding at the commissary. Now I can't stop using that word myself.
God, I'm not going.
The hell?
I used to call it the food room.
I used to call it the goddamn cafeteria. What's this, commissary? Were you in Soviet times?
With this said, what's going to be nice is that we're going to have such a funny justice, such a real human being on the court with Gorsuch. I mean, this guy, he's so down to earth and so like, you know, one of the guys. Just sit back and listen to a compilation put together by GQ of just how funny and self-effacing this guy is. I mean, this is honestly like, this is, if you've seen Westworld, like, they have generations of robots. And the early generations of robots just couldn't quite get there. They just didn't seem human.
They were stuck in the uncanny valley.
Yeah.
That's such a good one, Sam.
And Gorsuch, it's like, you know, the guys who were training him to do this were like, if we only had like three or four more years, we could maybe get this guy to come off as if any of this was sincere. But listen to this compilation. The world's most awkward portrayal of a human being that I've ever seen.
I'm not an algorithm. They haven't yet replaced judges with algorithms, though I think eBay's trying. whenever a lawyer says I'm just a lawyer from a small town, watch out. He's about last time you got to watch your wallet because it's gone quickly. And I'll never forget my first day on the job, carrying a pile of briefs up the steps to the bench. I tripped on the hem of my robe.
Pause.
Just about everything went flat.
Pause it. He's reading that anecdote. He's reading that anecdote.
This is A1 material.
No, but listen to what he's saying. He's reading, I will never forget that time that I went in. He would never forget it so much that he actually had to have that story written down for him.
That is correct.
That time that I tripped on my robe to show you that I'm not one of those highfalutin men in a black robe and take myself seriously.
I have been trained to destroy children's educational futures, let workers get hypothermia, and relate relatable anecdotes.
Day on the job, carrying a pile of briefs up the steps to the bench, I tripped on the hem of my robe, and just about everything went flying.
Pause for laugh.
I used to say she could teach a monkey how to read. I think she did. Me. I remember sitting next to the fire in his Oxford office. It's like something out of Harry Potter. And he always had a coal fireplace burning, and sometimes whether I was being raked over the coals. I wrote this 800-page book on. Makes a great doorstop, gift for Christmas. I cut a really bad deal on royalties. The robe does mean something to me, and not just that I can hide the coffee stains on my shirt.
What is a judge going to be bounded by?
Well, Senator, I hope it isn't what he had for breakfast.
I get constipation. You know, he did also say, he did make a point. Every time somebody brought up the Supreme Court hearing, finding that contradicted his opinion in that idea case involving the schools, he kept making the point that, like, I was handed it on my way to the bathroom. And I just so badly wanted...
I was about to defecate, and then all of a sudden, a case came along where I was forced, through no desire of my own, to destroy a child's life. What you gonna do?
But I honestly think that, like, he was trying to signal, like, I have normal biological functions. I'm actually a human. And I was just hoping that, like, Durbin would stump him by going, like, number one or number two?
Well, I had to urinate like a horse that races, and I was on my way to do just that when a case came along that said that black people weren't people, and sadly, not happily, I was forced to conclude that they are not. Aren't we all enjoying ourselves? Senator Whitehouse, I know you're liking my book material. You don't look like you want to kill me.
And then Ben Sasse was asking about, like, flying fishing and...
Flying fishing, that great human activity in the great outdoors that real Americans enjoy.
Did we do the Ted Cruz, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
Oh, this is like, this is like social reject overload here. All right. It's like Ted Cruz didn't even get the friendly robot model.
All right. Well, look, we got to take a break and head into the fun half of the program. Folks, your membership makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you support this program, you're supporting the free show that we do every day, which is, hopefully you're mildly entertained and somewhat informed, and you get to hear voices. Just this week, Masha Gessen, Zephyr Teachout.
I thought you were going to say Right Wing Mandela.
Right Wing Mandela.
What are you worried about Masha Gessen for?
Robot Gorsuch. Robot Gorsuch.
That is the voice that will be destroying the modern safety net of America for the next decade.
There you go. Until the next one we get. But Chuck Schumer said the filibuster is on. Call your senators. If you have a Democratic senator, call them and say, good for you on this filibuster. Don't even bother to ask if they're doing it. Just say, good for you on this filibuster. I can't wait to work for your reelection. This is what we need. filibuster. I don't care if Mitch McConnell gets rid of it. Now's the time to fight. And
there's actually audio of Gorsuch preparing for his hearings. It's like he goes, "We will have a master race, and then we will submit for our original reading of Costa." Oh, excuse me. Yeah, so anyways, one time I was trying to go to the bathroom. Well, what do you know? I had to strike down voting rights for women. Can't vote anymore. Not happy about it. My mom certainly wasn't.
So jointhemajorityreport.com. And again, if you can't afford, and as a way of saying thank you, we give you an hour plus extra content every day. 99.9% of the time, I think we do that. And if you can't afford it and want the extra content, I know we have a lot of people, you lose your job, or maybe you've had to stop working for a while to take care of a parent, that having a couple hours extra of stuff to listen to every day is helpful. Don't hesitate to email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will hook you up. We're going to make a deal.
Yeah, no shame in that. And then people step up when they get back on their feet. They really do.
Yeah. All right. And also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Take 10% off of your delicious coffee order. You can also get the Majority Report blend. Give it as a gift. Maybe we should redo that package too, Kelly. We're going to see folks. It's sold out, the live show. We're going to figure out a way maybe that other people can watch it or hear it afterwards. We'll see. And see you in the fun half, 646-257-3920.